Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Vanessa Richardson. I'm filling in for Alicia Woodgate, who could not be with us tonight. But I'm the 21st Century Speakers Series Chair of Inforum here at the Commonwealth Club, and I'm welcoming you to tonight's event, Digital Rights Management, The Battle Over Content Rages On. Tonight we have an all-star panel for you. Talal Shamoon, Dan Putterman, Krishnan Rajakopalan, John Williams, Ian Ballin, and our moderator, Wall Street Journal's Don Clark. So please give them a hand for being here. I also just wanted to let you know that Inforum is putting on lots of great events here at the Commonwealth Club. And if you're not familiar with Inforum, it's a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s. And if you join, you receive discounts to all club events. On February 9th, we have Franz and Kurt Weisner to discuss Honeymoon with My Brother. And on February 16th, we'll be taking a closer look at the many Africas. Before we begin, I also want to thank IBD Networks for their continued support of our business forums. This program is being taped for television, so please turn off your cell phones. And now to kick off tonight's program, please welcome Don Clark. He's the Wall Street Journal San Francisco Deputy Bureau Chief and is a 24-year veteran who has played a significant role in shaping the journal's West Coast technology coverage. And here he is to take it away.
Thanks, Vanessa. So, DRM is the product nobody really wants, but everybody's going to get anyway. The acronym stands for Digital Rights Management, and it's the technology that allows people who hold the rights, that is, the copyrights on materials such as music and movies, to set rules for how their content is used. DRM can be simple, or it can be sophisticated. For example, DRM software could be set to make it impossible for you to copy a movie you downloaded from the internet or a piece of music. Or the software could allow you to listen to a song, for example, three times for free, but require you to pay 99 cents if you want to listen to it again. If media companies are going to be successfully moved to the internet, they have to use DRM technologies in ways that protect their interests without setting off a backlash among consumers who will try to find ways to evade unreasonable DRM restrictions. We've assembled here an impressive panel of experts on the issues. Talal Shamoon is the CEO of Intertrust, a Silicon Valley company that develops and licenses intellectual property for digital rights management, digital policy management, and trusted computing. Before joining Intertrust, Talal worked as a research scientist at NEC Research in Princeton, where he was one of the pioneers of spread spectrum media watermarking. We won't ask him to explain what that is. Daniel Putterman is chairman, president, and CEO of Mediabolic, another Silicon Valley company that is a leading provider of end-to-end software solutions for connected entertainment products. A technology industry veteran, he founded the company in 1999, has been the silent visionary behind the company's success. Well, I'm not sure how silent he is, but there it is. Krishnan Rajakopalan is the vice president of digital media technologies in the Office of Technology at the Motion Picture Association of America. Krishnan's focus is on activities that are related to the internet and PC platform, including standards such as DLNA, Coral, and Internet 2. Prior to that, he was director of technology at Sony Connect and Sony Pictures before joining the MPAA. John Williams, next, is president and co-founder of Music Giants, the only high-fidelity music download service delivering content from all of the major labels. Prior to that, he was co-founder of Destination Film Distribution Company. He has extensive background in internet media distribution and content licensing and is also a lawyer. Ian Ballin, a final guest here, is intellectual property attorney with Greenberg Taurig LLP and executive director of the Stanford Center for E-Commerce. He represents technology, media, and entertainment companies in complex litigation and counseling related to copyright, trademark, trade secret, database, and computer and internet law issues. So let's talk a little bit about what DRM is and where we got to before we got here today. So, Talal, I've asked you to give a little bit of history of just what we're talking about when we talk about DRM and what has shaped the landscape so far.
Thanks, Don. So DRM is an interesting topic for many reasons. I've seen very few technologies over the last few years which rankle people and incite people to have such strong opinions. We were joking in the prep room before we came in here that DRM, if you did a ranking, at least over the last 6 months, of things that really irritated people on the Internet, DRM was somewhere between bird flu and the Iraq War. So obviously a lot of people seem to care about it, partially because over the last few years at least, the technology's really been associated with preventing people from doing things rather than enabling people to do things. And usually when a disruptive technology breaks onto the scene, that evaluation is done in consumers' minds right away. The other interesting aspect of DRM as a technology is it's changing in terms of what people call DRM. In the broadest sense, we like to think of it as a subset of a class of technologies called trusted computing or trusted object processing technologies. In the broadest sense, it really talks to not only how you protect or sell a music file or a video, but it can go on to really reach to how you protect a medical record or how you protect insurance files and so on in the digital space. And I think tonight, really, our focus, if you look at the panel and what people think of in terms of rights management systems, are really focused on consumer electronics applications of the technology. The field is not really new. It's gained prominence since the Napster and the MP3 wars of the late 90s. It's been around for, probably since the early 90s, late 80s in different forms, and really sort of broke into the entertainment industry as a result of the fact that due to a major paradigm shift called broadband and fast PCs, compact discs could be compressed into small amounts of data and then basically emailed from place to place. And all of a sudden the music industry found themselves with absolutely no protection for what amounted to perfect renditions of their products, and had to very quickly figure out a new business model and really create an instant demand for the technology. My company, Intertrust, was founded in 1990 and somewhat credited with the invention of a lot of the technologies that are used in DRM. Now, today, DRM is actually in all around us. It's ships in every copy of the Windows operating system. Apple has been very good at using it to sell a lot of music with iTunes, and it's being deployed as we speak on telephone networks and cable networks and so on. And while there have been some unfortunate incidents over the last few years where DRM's really sort of stuck in people's craw as technology that prevents you from doing stuff, there have been some very good cases of DRM being very enabling. iTunes, of course, is the best one. And we're moving right now from sort of a negative connotation of technology that's preventative to one where people are beginning more and more to use it to create real electronic commerce environments that consumers can benefit from.
Thanks, Talal. One of the starting points for DRM is whether consumers have a right to make copies of things that they have. And it's sort of become assumed that we do. But I'd like to talk a little bit about that because it's not necessarily a settled legal question. And so I'd like John Williams of Music Giants to give a little start about, you know, do we have this fair use right to make copies of our content?
Keep it real short on this one.
Get up close to the microphone, John.
Yeah, sorry. At Music Giants, we're licensed by all the labels. In order to be licensed by all the labels, you have to sell stuff with DRM wrapped around it. Our main pitch for our company is to keep things convenient, and DRM typically makes things as inconvenient for customers as possible, so that we still kind of fight that out. As far as the question goes of whether or not you have a fair use right, probably not. It's unsettled at this point whether or not a film company would come after you for making a copy. In the music space, it's as close to settled because the RIAA in its testimony in the Grokster decision said, we wouldn't go after somebody for making a copy of a CD for their personal use. A consumer probably has that capability. Does that mean that personal right is delegable to a professional installer that you would have come into your house, for instance, and install your home theater and then digitize your film collection or music collection for you? And that's pretty clear that that's not allowed. So as far as fair use goes for music, probably not a fair use right, but likely that nobody's going to come after you. Movies, remains to be seen. If it became a big enough issue, yeah, the studios will definitely come after you. And then as far as television, that is left unclear as to whether you can make a copy for personal use. It's clear that you can't make a copy for somebody else to use.
Yeah, particularly in high volumes, you know, the classic pirated DVD-CD duplication plant, that's sort of like the main targets. And obviously, the big peer-to-peer file-sharing services have become a huge legal issue because they have, fomented file transfers on a massive scale. Ian I wanted to ask you about one of the decisions John just mentioned, which is the Grokster case, which was a very seminal Supreme Court decision that affected the file-sharing services. Talk a little bit about that and what it said and what it means as far as whether these free sites will have a legal, free ride, so to speak.
Sure. The Grokster decision is an extremely important decision. It's a 9-0 decision, which from the Supreme Court to get all nine justices to agree on almost anything is really astonishing. And what the court did is they adopted a new test for liability. It's an additional ground on which liability can be imposed, essentially to plug a hole that had been created by the Ninth Circuit in the Grokster decision. The test that they created is for a cause of action for inducement. And the claim essentially is a three-part test. It requires a showing of intent to bring about infringement, distribution of a product suitable for infringing use, and evidence of direct liability. If a company intends to bring about infringement, they can be held liable. It's actually very simple. And the flip side to it is there's the broad safe harbor for legitimate technology companies, companies that put forward technologies that could be misused but ultimately are put forward for the right purpose and for a legitimate intent. Because of that, what it does is it makes it crystal clear that services such as Grokster that were put out there essentially to monetize third-party acts of infringement are not legitimate. They're illegal. And indeed, since the Grokster decision, we've seen similar decisions around the world. That has paved the way for legitimate distribution of content. And I think because of the safe harbor provision, the Supreme Court really created a balance that is supportive of both of the rights of copyright owners and of technology companies.
Thank you. So we have seen a lot of litigation directed by the RIAA at consumers and other things. So that probably, combined with some good legal decisions, will make it certainly more problematic than, or more dangerous for people to engage in wholesale file sharing. I don't think anybody thinks it's going to go away tomorrow. But let's hear a little bit from the standpoint of the content holders. I mean, I think they get sort of demonized as just wanting to stop everything. And I think, through the example of iTunes, et cetera, some legitimate content holders are coming forward with trying to strike a balance with things that they will allow and maybe things that they won't allow. I'd like to get Krishnan Rajagopalan from the MPAA, which represents movie companies, to talk a little bit about what are some of the do's and don'ts that content holders are looking forward to trying to enforce through DRM.
In general, I'd like to say that there's no single set of rules that the content owners would like to enforce on any piece of content. It really depends on sort of the business model and the distribution channel that you're looking at. And the idea really is to create a lot of consumer choice by providing different tiers of services with different usage rights and allowing consumers to pick price points at which they acquire their content, which in turn comes with a set of usage rights. The key to note here is that, DRM technologies, since they provide the underlying infrastructure to support rich usage rights, are key in enabling this functionality. The problem right now, I think, is that DRMs are still sort of in their first phase of evolution. They don't have the rights. They don't have the flexibility, I believe, to express all these different usage rights. And we certainly see the evolution of DRMs to be more flexible, more transparent, and allow sort of the seamless transfer of content across the home network. So the end consumer is not really affected or doesn't see DRM, but behind the scenes, it actually manages to protect the content of the content owners.
Right, Talal, you've obviously, your company has been working on this since 1990. What are some of the more sophisticated scenarios that the DRMs you are familiar with can enable besides just stopping copying?
Well, I mean, actually, DRM is much more than an access control technology. It's about actually implementing things like rentals and subscriptions and, you know, paper plays and, you know, try and buys and things like that. And, of course, as technology evolves, things like wireless and peer-to-peer technology sort of come online. You'll see even richer applications of that being added on. DRM was created out of a need to create commerce in the digital space. I mean, originally, you know, four cavemen and a couple of things they wanted to trade, and that sort of built up into physical commerce. And ultimately, we ended up in a world where value was exchanged and contracts were written and stores worked a certain way and you had locks on. You couldn't walk in and walk out with a lobster without paying for it. People want to do that in the electronic space. And I'm not talking about, oh, you go to Amazon and you buy an iPod on your shopping cart. People want to buy a digital good and consume it on a rendering device. You want to buy a song and play it on a music player. You want to buy a movie and watch it on a TV. And the same way that when you're buying, you know, lobsters, you're buying, you know, cars or whatever, there are rules and all sorts of different business models that are associated with that type of physical commerce. People are going to want to build that in the electronic space. And DRM technology really enables those types of electronic exchanges of value, as much as the imagination or as much as the business market can tolerate, mm-hmm. to take place.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Putterman of Mediabolic, what are some of the, from the consumer standpoint, what are some of the downsides that you're aware of? Obviously, you make software that people use in goods, and you come across this.
Well, I think, you know, with respect to DRM technologies, I mean, I first want to say to Christian's credit, the whole DRM content holder side of things has gotten a bit of a bad rap, partially due to the fact that there are technology companies implementing DRM schemes. And as such, there's a natural propensity to keep these schemes locked up on islands. I mean, I think Microsoft could be held guilty of that. And certainly if we look at what Apple is providing from an end-user experience today is enjoyable. There's nothing like instantly downloading a video, getting onto our iPod, taking it on an airplane ride. I personally enjoy that experience. One of the trends that we all know is happening is that all of these devices, whether it's from the broadcast world, consumer electronics, network equipment, et cetera, it all needs to work together. We're going to get to a point standards like DLNA are helping it to be, regardless of vendor, we should be able to, as consumers, buy a device that should work. Just to wrap it up, for those of you who have seen recently, Linksys announced a $99 wireless audio player that plays Yahoo Music subscription content from a PC. The moment we try to push play on Fair Play restricted iTunes content, it's not going to work. And I guarantee you the error message is not going to be friendly. So my big concern right now is that end users, oh, we're all investing in this content, and we're going to be told in the near future that we can't enjoy it in places that we'd like to without the right brand names in the products.
You jump ahead to the interoperability question. Let's pursue that a little more. The almost obvious example is Apple, because it has the dominant share now of downloaded music, and it likes selling iPods too, so it doesn't make it easy to, for example, I think it's buy iTunes music and put it on your somebody else's player, that sort of thing. What incentive does a market leader like that, like Apple, have to open up and connect to the rest of the world? John, is that something you can get into?
Yeah, for Apple, it has zero incentive, and you probably won't ever see it change. not while they have 83% market share. If they were to switch market share with the rest of the world, you might see them consider change, but I don't think you'll see a change.
Would you think then that position would gradually tend to lead them to lose their market share and eventually...
Yeah, well, I think what ends up happening is the rest of the world gets together and makes things interoperate so that the consumer experience is as nice as it is with using iTunes on an iPod. I mean, those two things, the service is married to the software that's married to the hardware. They did a complete solution. Nobody's ever done it before, and they did it really well. They set a very high bar for folks. So, but I'll tell you that there's way more money being invested in this space than Apple is spending on trying to maintain its lead by companies that are trying to upset Apple and upset Apple's lead. Sony, Microsoft, watch Cisco start spending money in this space. Is it nothing plays with an iPod? And if the world is, we sell through a lot of professional installers, and those professional installers are in the process of installing $100,000 to million-dollar systems for people's homes, and they get to the point where they say, well, okay, so how does it play on my iPod? Oh, it doesn't. And that is frustrating to people, and that if the rest of the world can provide a convenient solution, then I think you'll start seeing things change a little bit.
Talal Shamoon of Intertrust, your company had a hand in playing and organizing an organization called Coral, which is about making DRMs play together, I believe, and other things interoperate. What are some of the issues you can get into technology as well as politics, but what are some of the hard parts about making things work together?
Well, there's two hard parts. One is the actual plumbing, the technology. Coral's focus, it's now a group, it's an open standards body that we jointly founded with Fox and a bunch of technology companies 2 years ago now, or 1 year, I forgot when. But the idea was to leave the security part of the system up to individual implementers and then try to figure out a way that the two DRM systems could talk to each other without really needing to get to know each other intimately. This type of technology is generally very paranoid and very unfriendly and doesn't like other things that do the same thing. So Coral was about coming up with a layer that different DRM systems could interoperate with. And doing that right and doing it so it works as well as an iPod is a tricky problem. And that's something, you know, you throw enough engineers at it and over time they'll come up with a good solution. And they've done that. The other part is the policy part. And Coral now involves all four major record labels and I think all but two of the studios. There's a lot of participation from content. The MPAA is a member, the RIAA is a member. And entertainment industry would like to see is a common set of behaviors around content. I mean, earlier I was talking about how DRM could do everything from butter your toast to sell you music. And that tends not to be a smart way to enter a market. And there's been a little bit of Apple bashing here, but I think one of the things that Jobs has done really well is kept it really simple and kept the rights management completely out of people's faces and focused on enablement. And I think that is a Promethean gift to electronic commerce. That said, you know, you want to be able to do that across devices from different vendors, across different operating systems, and so on and so forth. And for that to happen, you have to make sure that a song from Warner Music doesn't do different things than a song from Universal Music beyond a certain point. Because consumers have an expectation that you hit the play button and the stuff's just going to play. So there's a lot of policy work being done at Coral right now to come up with at least sets of things that songs will do similarly, sets of things that movies will do similarly, so that when you do try to run them on a device from Cisco, who is a Coral member, or a device from Sony, they'll at least behave the same way, regardless of the bits and bytes that are actually operating on the music underneath the player's skin.
Krishnan, from your standpoint, what are some of the issues surrounding interoperability? Is that something that the MPAA tries to foster?
Absolutely. I mean, I think interoperability is one of the biggest challenges we have in front of us. Certainly as content owners, we'd like people to get content and use it fairly across all their devices without being blamed for not being able to enable it. To that end, we actually actively participate in a number of standards activities because we certainly see standards as being the only way to achieve interoperability. I mean, you need to get consumer CE and IT and the content industry together in an open forum to try and define the standard. And so Coral is one of the sort of mentioned standards that we are participating in, which has a DRM interoperability framework. We also participate in DLNA, which is the Digital Living Network Alliance home networking standard. They actually have they've started to focus on content protection and are looking to adopt an interoperable content protection scheme so that content can, in fact, go across, you know, the network at home. And so we are very actively in there trying to promote the adoption of any content protection. We don't particularly have any, technology choices. We just want to make sure it gets done. And then on a completely separate note, people, talk about the Internet PC platform a lot, but there's a whole initiative in the satellite and cable broadcasting world as well. And if you look at DVB, which is the Digital Video Broadcasting Standard, which basically the rest of the world usually uses, we are actually used, we are very actively looking at content protection and content management, which is a specification for content protection on next generation broadcasting technologies. Mm-hmm. And it actually includes the concept of a whole network and interoperability and so forth. So we are very active in this space, and we absolutely want to see it happen.
Mm-hmm. One of the most high-profile events of the past year involving DRM was what Sony did, the Sony record portion, where they inserted, you know, the record industry didn't like the fact, or they wanted to go back in time and fix the fact that they hadn't put DRM on their discs, and Sony put some without telling people, and it turned out to be a vehicle for some sort of viruses, and they had to recall it, and it became a huge hoo-ha. Ian Ballin, from a standpoint of the law, does a content holder have any obligation to disclose what sort of technologies he's using, or what do you think is sort of like the liability situation of a company like Sony in that situation?
Well, I mean, I think as a general proposition, it's important to disclose what a particular program does. But the reality is, you know, technology is not infallible, and there are often unintended consequences. The thing that's very interesting is as consumers, our interest and our excitement for digital content has increased dramatically. There was concern recently expressed, for example, that Apple had a service that would make suggestions to us when we logged on to the website about other songs we might be interested in. No personal information was collected. Apple collected nothing. This was all done automatically by computers, and yet there was a big hue and cry about that. And I think that's really emblematic, that what we see is almost a knee-jerk reaction when things happen, and a concern about privacy rights, even in situations when, in fact, our personal information isn't being collected and when there isn't a downside. So I think it's just our expectations have gone so far ahead of where the market is, and that's something that needs to be put in check. But in terms of the law, DRM is really more a tool that enforces rules, and the rules can be enforced through contract. There are provisions such as the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that prevent young kids around the world from hacking into these systems without legal consequence. You know, you can't stop people from trying to break these systems, but the reality is the law assists it. But law alone is not going to stop all of these problems. What you need to look at is law in conjunction with education. And it's really, I think, in many ways, the content industry today is where the software industry was in the 1980s. I remember, you know, 20 years ago or more, people, including people at major educational institutions, incredulous at the idea that you'd have to pay money for another copy of an operating system on a computer. Well, the world has changed, and it's not just law, it's education. And I think we're going to see that change with content as well. Mm-hmm.
So I want to get some more of the things we're going to see in the future. Daniel Puterman, you talk to a lot of device companies. You're selling software to them. What do you get the sense of in terms of what the electronics industry wants to do as far as enabling new kinds of usage of content and how they're going to try to protect it?
Okay. So, I mean, I think the holy grail for us is the ability to walk into a store, buy a device for whatever purpose we need it for at that time. It may be to listen to music, it may be to store some digital photos off of our PC, et cetera. And regardless of the brand of device that we purchased, and regardless of its specific inherent capability, a strong desire to have all these devices just work together and work together seamlessly. One comment I'd like to add on the DRM side is DRM implementation, unlike traditional consumer electronics, is software. And software requires computational power and memory. That's really at odds, if you will, with consumer devices that are meant to achieve a price point that the average everyday consumer can walk into Best Buy and purchase. So as such, I mean, on a daily basis now, we are seeing issues related to building these devices where the implementation of some of the security schemes is actually making it more difficult to bring the devices to market. Having said that, you know, and in the spirit of the DRM discussion, clearly content and interoperability transcending any particular DRM scheme. I mean, let's just say it another way. The fact that an end user should have to know what DRM stands for means we already have an issue that we have to solve. And so interoperability, I mean, we hear about these new standards, DLNA, UPnP, Intel has their Vive marketing initiative out there, but this is just one book of standards. The actual technological implementation across the board is actually much more deep than that.
So CDs came out and they were essentially unprotected. DVDs came out and they thought they were protected. Then some Norwegian teenager cracked it. And so then we're now talking about the Blu-ray and HD DVD standards for high-definition content. Talal, what do you know about how this is going to be protected, and do you think they're going to fare any better at keeping it locked up than the last disk standards?
Well, from what I've been able to follow, what's going on over there, there will be protection technology applied to the content on these disks. One of the things that both of the disk formats have spent a lot of time doing, though, is focusing not on just preventing people from taking the content off the disk, but actually levitating the content legally off the disk into a computer and then using it in other places. And I think designers of these technologies have finally realized that there are ways of securely moving the content from place to place without really reminding the owner of the disk that the content is protected as long as they use it the way it's supposed to be used, then using it in all sorts of different places. And I think you'll see that. To double-click a bit on sort of what's coming next, I think that in addition to these interoperable technologies, the next generation of consumer devices will enable a lot of, ironically, a lot of the uses that people have come to expect from piracy in the legal domain. It's, one of the really cool aspects of BitTorrent is the ability to pull a piece of content from someone else's computer that you've never met. Now, unfortunately, before the poison dart hits me in the side of the head, unfortunately, that's usually a stolen piece of content, mm-hmm. right? And that's bad. What a lot of the stuff we're working on with consumer electronics companies is about is adding security to that type of experience so you can do that, pull content off someone else's machine and possibly have all sorts of nifty business models associated with it in a legal way that allows the content owners to make money. And I think that's going to be a very attractive area because you already have millions of consumers who are conditioned to use the technology in a certain way. They've been stealing the stuff. So the trick is to convert those into legitimate paying people, and that'll be good for everybody, including the guys who sell devices. The other thing is the expansion of what's being called, the technical buzzword is the home domain. And I'm not sure it's going to be called the home domain when it finally gets to the consumer public, but the idea is that a person or a family, group of people living together, own a bunch of devices and a bunch of content. And they want to do different things with a device and a given content item. So, and the technology will be used to help people juggle content, their devices, and the different members of their family, their community, together so that they can really play the right stuff in the right place at the right time. And I think that's an emerging area that's also enabled here. Mm-hmm. With respect to hacking, this stuff is always going to get broken. And it's really about, for the content company or the service provider, selling stuff about risk management much more than total security. And people just have to factor in that you create a certain amount of value, you educate the consumers up to a certain point, and you bet on the human characteristic of wanting to perform within a community of rules than just wanting to break the system and work outside it. And the probability of an attack always increases when people feel disenfranchised. So you'll see technologies trying to convert people that way as well by creating value.
So as successful as iTunes have been, most people say, look, and it's X million. They still look at illegal content as Y million, and it's a lot bigger. I'd like to get some predictions as to, is that going to cross soon or where things are at? John, what do you think?
I didn't catch it.
Basically, the volume of illegal content being exchanged still is a lot more than the unit volume
of
legal.
Yeah.
Is it going to be the same ratio as now, or do you think the percentage of legal is going to get better?
Yeah, I think they'll both grow as the population of the world gets more bandwidth. Right now what's the number on broadband users around the world? I think it's like 100 million or 150 million broadband users. There's 4 billion, 4.1 billion, 4.2 billion, because it grows that fast. as those people get broadband, more people are going to have the opportunity to use the tools that broadband enables you to do, or be able to get the access to the content that they want to have access to. So I think the illicit services will grow, and I think that the legal services will grow, and the pot just gets bigger. I mean, there's a service in Russia right now called All of MP3, and I don't know if you've seen it, because eventually it'll be All of DVD too. And it's technically legal in the one neighborhood in Russia where, but if you ask the labels, no, it's not legal, but they can't ever shut them down. And it turns out that more files are purchased because they charge you, like, you can get the entire Beatles catalog for $6 or something like that. Well, you can't get any of the Beatles catalog from a legal service, no matter how much you pay.
Right.
But that service, more files get purchased from that service than from iTunes, by far. So, you know, I'm not advocating going and doing that because it's illegal. But the answer to your question is, I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of great legal services, and there's going to be a lot of great illegal services.
And you don't think that the technologically will be able to limit them very much?
No, I think that I live this every single day. We've got a lot of issues just internally. I've got customers that have 27 rooms that they want to use their files in. It's their own house. Shouldn't they be able? They bought the file from us, or they bought.
And
there's
27 hard drives with a copy each.
There's 27 clients out there. Mm-hmm. Try to figure that out. It's impossible, because what ends up happening is it breaks all the rules that we end up setting with the labels for use of that content, because that guy all of a sudden looks like a Napster node, mm-hmm. or the old Napster node, right. or a Kazaa node. But in reality, it's just one guy's house, and that guy's got three houses.
Mm-hmm. Three houses with 27 rooms each?
Oh, well, some of them are, yeah. Yeah, one guy's got a kingdom.
That guy, you know, he's got to buy a bunch of CDs.
I think he can afford to pay a license.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that we learn something. We don't even know the problems that we're going to address 5 months from now, 6 months from now, because we learn that as the technology, as we start implementing into people's houses. Your suggestion that, oh, the Roku device, it'll work for streaming, and you wouldn't be able to play a song from iTunes. Well, guess what? You won't be able to play a song from Music Giants either, and it's a Plays for Sure device. Right, and we use Windows Media DRM. And the reason is not because the DRM's broken, or it's just nobody ever figured out that you would ever want to use a device in one room playing files from a different room.
Got it.
So we learned that. Now we're solving that problem, and I think we'll end up seeing this whole process evolve very quickly.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Pardon me. I wanted to just add one point, which is we've been defining DRM as technology and a set of rules that restricts copying and restricts usage. Hopefully in a way where users are still excited about it. There's a complementary technology that I think is as integral component to DRM, and that is digital watermarking. And it's actually widely employed right now. We don't see it because it's invisible to us, but in the majority of content situations, especially in the case of commercial video, we can actually find out the original source of that content. And, you know, at least as a provider of devices into the space, this is a much more friendly way of catching copy protection schemes that are going to be broken because hackers see it as a challenge rather than a restriction. And I think it's something that we need to pay more attention to.
You know, I hate to be an optimist here, but I think that that we're going to see a growth of legal content, and I think it will eclipse illegal content. The reality is, you know, since time immemorial, people have been stealing things, but that's a small fraction of the population. I think attitudes have to change. As long as people were using the Grokster services, because everyone was using the Grokster services, and because those defendants were saying this is legitimate and it's legal, you had a larger group of the population that was using the services because they believed it was legitimate. And I think attitudes will change in part as a a result of some of the legal decisions that have come down. Frankly, people who would go to LimeWire and get a free song are not going to walk across the street to the Virgin Megastore and stick a CD or a DVD in their pocket and walk out the door because they know that's wrong. Well, with the changing legal environment, people will also understand. And even though you can't control what people do in other parts of the world, you know, I have to say, particularly as a litigator who represents clients in litigation in the United States, if you look at a company like Sharman Networks, they were an entity organized under the laws of Vanuatu, whatever those laws may be. You know, and yet, because their business model...
Not they have laws?
Right. but because their business model depended on U.S. revenue, they were amenable to jurisdiction here in California. And that's really the key. If you want to operate in some far-flung part of the world and operate locally, well, maybe you can get away with it. But as long as you're targeted to the U.S. market or to other major countries, the reality is these kind of services are going to become increasingly more sub rosa services, and I think we're going to see legitimate content flourish.
Christian, I'd like to end this section with you. What are some of the optimistic signs you guys are seeing at the MPAA?
Well, certainly, I mean, I think the proliferation of sort of new legitimate services that are now trying to compete with iTunes and make it as easy as possible for consumers to acquire content is one very good sign. We are also betting that consumers will ultimately prefer quality over getting it for free, and we're focusing on efforts on things like high def, you know, content and content that actually, from a quality standpoint, is, you know, vastly superior to content that you can get on, you know, peer-to-peer networks. So, and I think finally, to borrow a cliche, you know, I think we fundamentally believe that people are in fact honest, and what's keeping them, what's basically causing them to go to P2P networks at this point is basically the lack of options, or legal options, things that are easy to use, that are not so expensive and actually let you do what you want with the content. And as those things change, as DRM technologies evolve, I think we'll start, you know, consumers starting to basically switch to legit services, and that's what we believe.
And as far as, I think, Ian, you were talking about this, as far as the international legal framework, are other countries starting to change their laws to be a little more in harmony with ours?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, part of the problem is that the law lags behind changes in technology and new business models, and things happen very quickly. So it's not so much that the laws of other countries, you know, have changed as much as courts in the United States and in other countries have grown accustomed to dealing with internet issues. And I mean, you know, shoot, I remember having a software infringement case in Boston in 1989 where we were before a judge who was involved in helping Czechoslovakia develop a new constitution. That was really, really interesting to him. When we walked into court talking about computers, his eyes glazed over. He didn't have a computer. He didn't know how to operate computers, and he wasn't much interested in our case. The world has changed, and I think the reality is, just as we have seen courts in this country understand new technologies, we're seeing that internationally as well. And in most of the major countries of the world, there are legitimate legal protections in place.
Great. I think we have time to go to the audience for some questions. I hope you have some. I believe we have a microphone over there. Is that right? And if you have a question, go up and fire away. And if you know who you want to address it to, that would be great. If anybody is ready to come. I think while we're waiting for them to line up, I just one thing that I think Talal touched on and which Intertrust was founded around was the concept of super distribution, maybe, you know, people passing on content and actually, you know, maybe you could almost like get a VIG or something, get some sort of payment. Is that concept? I haven't seen it really, you know, crystallize as a business model yet, but do you think that's coming?
Oh, I definitely think so. The new technology platforms that are coming out support those models. I mean, it's a controversial business model in some content communities, and different content companies may or may not license content for that use, but the technology supports it, and there are content companies that would like to promote that.
Good. Sir, would you like to ask a question?
Yes, I would. Could you speak to, and this is to anybody on the panel, speak to basically the wireless mobility devices and what's the role of distribution CATV vendors versus content vendors? How is that going to change over this next 5-6 years?
You mean particularly with regard to cable TV or?
Yeah, Comcast. Is Comcast out of business? Is it a dinosaur waiting for the meteor to hit? Or
Comcast specifically is, I think, very much in business. And of all of the cable companies in the United States, Comcast has spent very, very aggressively getting behind new technologies If the boxes they have available in the Bay Area are fantastic. They have hard disks in them. They're all set up for all sorts of really interesting content offerings. They also have networking technology in them that allows you, hasn't been turned on yet, but if you look at all those holes on the side and the back of the box, they allow you to connect devices to that thing and move from there. So that can only foreshadow what could be coming. There will be the service providers in general, cable companies, satellite companies, and phone companies, there will be some suffering there because there are certain of them who are very wedded to the old model of creating a walled garden and locking their subscribers in. And in an age of Yahoos and Googles, where all you've got to do is type the URL of somebody else into the web browser and you're there, people who are going to cling to using technology to bound people in are not going to do very well. But, you know, you've got some of the phone companies out there and some of the cable companies out there are very, very progressive, and they're really focused on the consumer.
And you mentioned the word wireless. One of the things I think that's going on is that there's been some agreement on standards for protecting the bits as they go from room to room, which was something I think a lot of people were worried about, and I think there's some agreement there which is going to ultimately get your cable signal beamed around your house probably in a few years more easily.
And if that part doesn't work, they'll just change the law, which is what they do right now.
Which law are you referring to?
Both the telephone companies and the cable companies are probably the two largest employers of attorneys out there. When something doesn't go their way, they change the law. That's, you know, there was when broadband hit the scene, COVADs of the world that were allowed to use the network, the infrastructure, and the telephone companies claimed, oh, wait a second, that's below our cost. Well, what's your cost? And they could never pinpoint what those costs were. So they ended up changing some rules to allow free access. And those free access laws ended up constricting what could actually be consumed by a end user through a third party that wasn't the incumbent telephone company. And the cable companies will end up doing the same thing. So, and I think they'll fail during that process because there are going to be other big companies like Microsoft or like a Google or like a Yahoo or like an AOL that have just as much incentive to fight them in that regard to make sure that consumers have open access through their proprietary technologies to the content that they're after.
Go ahead, another question.
Several of you guys have made the assertion that DRM also enables things. And I think that what DRM mostly enables is different business models, like letting you try something out, for example. But for consumers who already have the content, I've downloaded the thing, it's on my computer, I want to use it, DRM only limits me. It doesn't enable me to use that content in another way. It only prevents me from using it more times than you want me to, or that kind of thing. You made the assertion that there are always going to be some services or illegal methods by which to acquire something, and that your objective is to create a DRM-enabled alternative that is accessible. But given that now I can go and download a movie or an album without DRM for free, or I can pay to have one that limits my access now that I have it, what possible incentive do I have as a consumer to actually use your system?
Ian?
Well,
kind of hard to answer anything but zero.
let me ask you a question. What do you do for a living?
I work at CNET.
CNET, okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, CNET maybe isn't a good example. We talk about the Wall Street Journal. You know, I bought the Wall Street Journal this morning. You know, I think it's a good paper. Does that mean that I have the right to get their subscription service without paying for it? You know, I'm a lawyer. Trust me, if I could do the same work I was doing for free instead of getting paid, you'd get even more value for what you're paying. The reality is, to some extent, as consumers, we've gotten used to getting so much access to so many things. We've forgotten that in some sense, a lot of those things would disappear if there wasn't a way to monetize it. I mean, I can't tell you the number of singers and actors and actresses in Hollywood who would be waiting tables or busing tables or parking cars right now instead of working on television shows or making records if all the content that was made available was free. So to some extent, you know, the Wall Street Journal, lawyers, artists, content companies have the right to monetize content. And we as consumers would love to have everything for free. But, you know, when that world exists, the first place I want to go to is Citibank, because that machine, the ATM machine, I want to have work for free. Well,
but that didn't really answer my question, though. Yeah, why would I use your system?
No, wait. The answer is it's illegal. You can go and get it for free. It's illegal. So,
but you can't enforce that law.
But, well, unfortunately, well, yeah, you can.
But I think the question, though, I mean, yeah. I think you buy the fact that it's illegal. What you're saying is Joe Sixpack out there, you know, in the privacy of his own bedroom, doesn't really, no one's watching, illegal. Not what incentive does he have to play within the system? And that's sort of a business question, not really.
I mean, I think. And that's what the second part of my answer was going to be. But your apps, the point is, do we as an industry, and we have different players here, have an obligation to consumers to make sure that it's as simple to buy it as to steal it? Absolutely. Otherwise, we're all dead. Content owners all the way through the service providers and the DRM providers and everyone else, and the lawyers.
Yeah, and the reality is individual use is not a problem in the same way that distribution is. I mean, if you look at things, it's not the individual and the privacy of their home that's stealing content. It's people who are making millions of copies available online. They're the ones who are the bigger targets. And the ones who are doing it on business models where they're trying to monetize other people's acts of theft, that's obviously the biggest problem.
I think as a parent of a kid who's probably downloaded like a billion songs, you know, and I tried to convey to him, you know, once iTunes became a very valuable medium, you know, you really want to buy this. And I think he does to some degree. I mean, the things that he can buy, and I certainly switched over. I actually prefer iTunes to Napster or the free service just because I think it's, you know, there's more, you know, try before buy. You know, it's a pretty good house. Morally, I like supporting the artist, but it's not a matter. It's sort of like jaywalking. You know, the cops aren't going to stop you for jaywalking. You know, it's just, do you jaywalk? What's the deal? Okay, let's have another question.
Ian, you just said that the key goal here is to stop the mass distribution, and especially the profiting from the mass distribution. But Talal, you were saying earlier that there's no such thing as an unbreakable DRM, that someone somewhere is likely to eventually break the DRM, even if it's not a widespread exploit, even if everybody can't do it in their home. My question is, given that there's going to be someone who can access an unprotected version of the content, and that someone is exceedingly likely to place it on a peer-to-peer network, why is DRM helpful for stopping peer-to-peer? And why is DRM more helpful for stopping peer-to-peer than it is harmful to getting people to adopt legal download services? John, you said early on, there was the implication, at least, that you wanted, I mean, if music giants could be DRM-free, you'd run it that way. What would it take for the content to be available in the most convenient way, which is without DRM?
Well, I don't want it to come out without DRM. I want the experience to the end user to be as though there wasn't DRM there. So I want it to work with every device, and we take that as our responsibility. So what would it take? I'll tell you, I fight battles inside of Microsoft. I fight battles inside of every single device manufacturer that would have the opportunity to touch one of our files, which means right now it's mostly the high-end audio equipment guys, to try to change how they use chipsets, and those chipsets need to have software on them. And so you're constantly fighting these battles. At Apple, they control the software, they control the hardware, and they control the content, and it's really easy to, when you have that picture, to be able to make that seamless.
So, I mean, what would it take would be another planet and another species.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you're
but,
saying,
you know, you want supermarkets without locks, you know, ATMs that just spit money out. I mean, this is about.
I want CDs at full quality that I can play in whatever I have now. I just want what I have now.
And you have it on iTunes.
No.
No, you don't.
No, I have compressed audio that I can't play on my Microsoft-based player. I can't play on my Mac. Excuse me, that I can't play on my PC very well. I don't have what I had before, and that's all I want.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, remember that the person setting the rules here is not really John. It's really all right. These. It's the publisher, the record label, the mm-hmm. All these people behind these legal people. John would have one model, but they insist on another. So
John writes checks. Every single right. person in the chain needs to mm-hmm. to eat, and they look to John to be able to do it. And then I look to all my users to pay me what we set as our retail price to be able to do that. So,
next question. Thank you.
Good evening. As an independent content provider, with the great demand and excitement about digital media content, what is the new landscape or model that would be provided to allow for, say, Hollywood, how they have a sort of monopoly on content, but because of the new technology and things are changing, what's on the horizon as far as independent content providers being able to get their content out there to the masses on an even playing field?
Excellent question. Anybody want to try it?
Sure. I mean, I think, the promise of the Internet is an open marketplace, and we've seen this established in other markets, and this is one that clearly is going to be in demand. If we look at podcasting, if we look at some early initiatives by Google and others, it's clear that there are going to be free markets available for content distribution, and based on the perceived value and popularity of your content, you can be paid accordingly. And I think it's an opportunity that needs to be embraced and will be special for everyone involved.
There are certainly people who make their living on the Internet who didn't have much of a living before that as far as artists and musicians, and not just new struggling artists. I like to tell the story when I'm researching music for a Shakespeare group I'm in. I enter strange words into the iTunes music store, like I entered the word Tarantella in there, and I found Alan Lomax field recordings from 1948 in Sicily, and I grabbed little pieces. So it's amazing the amount of content that's on there. I have no idea what the mechanism whereby an artist actually gets into iTunes, but everybody seems to be doing it, so it seems to work. Another question.
Yes. Talal Shamoon referred to the potential of DRM applications outside of commercial content. And just recently, Google agreed to censor search results for the Chinese government. I'm curious what would prevent DRM technologies from being used by similar regimes to control the flow of political content in the future.
Technology in general can be used, for good things and bad things, and I think all of these technologies have the potential to be used to really control the flow of information. That's much more about the way people mandate and build the technologies and employ them than it is about the technology itself. It's as much about operating systems and web technologies as it is about the specifics of DRM. What I was referring to is there's a lot of laws, like in the United States and Europe right now, that talk to how health records should be handled to protect privacy and to make sure that everything's touched by the right people and not touched by other people and so on. And there what happens is the health records are actually placed in protected containers with rules about who can access them and who can't. But you can obviously make that leap to saying all the data in my country must be in protected digital boxes, and you have to send me a report every time somebody reads that thing, and you get this big brother system proliferating out there. But that's got more to do with the fact that, there are some bad people out there than it does with the negatives of a specific technology.
Wouldn't it seem, though, that the choices that we make about the how we create the DRM technology at this stage would potentially enable that kind of political use of the technology later on?
Except for, I don't think the Chinese government goes down to Fry's and buys, third-party software, right? They've got labs.
But the Burmese government does do that.
I'm sorry?
The Burmese government does do
that. No, I understand that. But, I mean, the Burmese government are busy, shooting people, right? They've got, if I lived in Burma, I'd have much bigger problems than, who was reading my data. But, China is actually a really interesting case across the board, including when you were talking about intellectual property law. There's a lot of, billions of pirates in China. And, the Chinese government does have the resources to institutionalize all sorts of kind of technology policies like what they've done with Google that is potentially very scary. The flip side is all you need is a web browser and access to the open Internet to get out there and see what the rest of the world does. And that actually has the potential of creating democracy movements that can really put pressure on these governments to do the right thing, to move people in the right direction. And you see that happening in India today, and the presence of India on China's border will place pressure on China to actually act more like sort of a benevolent system rather than a malevolent system. But that's to be determined.
Good. Go ahead.
Somewhat related question. Given that Apple sells less than 100 songs for each iPod sold, and many people have more than 100 songs on their iPods, and iTunes, by its nature, knows who has what songs on their iPods, why can't, under the Grokster decision, the Justice Department subpoena Apple's records of all iTunes database users and what songs they've got? And just like they're subpoenaing Google and Microsoft's records of people's searches, go after all of the people who've put songs on their iPods that weren't correctly purchased?
Well, fundamentally, because the laws relating to child pornography are very different than the laws in copyright. And so we're looking at fundamentally different things. The Grokster decision actually protects the Apples of the world. When you have what we'd call a dual-use technology, something that that is fundamentally made available for legitimate purposes but could be used for infringement, Grokster creates protection for technology companies like Apple to the extent that they act with legitimate purpose without an intent to infringe, and it does provide that level of protection. Again, a company that acts differently or intends to infringe doesn't have that protection. But Grokster actually is very pro-technology in that sense. With respect to subpoenaing private records, again, you're... I think it's very difficult to compare concerns about child pornography with copyright infringement. They're just different things completely.
But from the point of view of going after someone, the point to hit is not really the iPod. The point to hit is how the content entered the person's home. And what's been happening with the RIAA is they've been going after your DSL line or your cable modem and what you do with it. And that's really the point. Because if you look at an iPod, those songs could have come off a CD, which you bought and owned and ripped. And CD ripping, it was once upon a time was challenged, but you know the music industry sort of let that one go. That goes back to Diamond Rio. So it
you're assuming, though, that those were ripped from a CD, and I think that's a huge assumption because I've got data that says that it's not. It's well, the majority of those songs on that iPod are probably
from some
service that is no longer in existence.
I think the gentleman's concern is much more about his privacy and where the government can go or where the RIAA could go. And the RIAA will probably spend more time with your ISP than they will with your iPod. That's all I'm saying.
To clarify, iTunes has a record of every song on every iPod that could be subpoenaed.
Assuming you've ever connected it to the iTunes Music Store, right?
No, if that's how you load music on your iPod.
Well, but I'm saying if you never went to you never bought any illegal music and you only ripped your own records and put it on your iPod, Apple wouldn't know that, would they?
Well, I also don't think your iTunes player uploads your entire music database or the information to Apple. That would be an outrage.
Unless it's disclosed in your terms of use.
are you aware of this?
What's that?
Are you aware of this? I don't think iTunes does this.
And then you have to get in the question of personally identifiable information versus aggregated. A lot of times, you know, there's a lot of information taken, but they don't say it's my file. They say it's user 123, and they don't necessarily link the two. So, but that's getting pretty granular. But I don't think I think whatever the technology can allow a lot of things. The question is has to do with how the company decides to gather the information and.
In order for that to actually happen, though, you'd have to have the content owners want to push for it. And I don't think there's a content owner out there from the label's perspective that wants to do anything other than cheer, you know, Steve Jobs on. He's done a great job for them because if it wasn't for him, their market caps would be worse off than they are.
They like
right
him
now.
To raise the price from 99 cents, though.
This, of course, applies to MSN, Yahoo, Google, any large aggregator, Amazon of content purchased electronically to individuals.
I think we have time for just one more question. I'd like to jump ahead to get one more questioner in.
So earlier you talked about recording media and recording TV, and it seems like that case was decided in Universal versus Betamax, and that time shifting was okay. So it seems like the content providers are trying to use a new angle to get digital rights management into new products and new technologies. You've also mentioned Apple and how that's such a great service, but they end up changing their license agreements, and you can only play a song on a certain number of computers. So my question is, what does the panel think of, or what is fair use, and what do you guys think of the number of copyright extensions that have been happening lately?
Let's, Christian, why don't you talk to that? I mean, do you think you can?
Well, actually,
you guys
I'm
have
not a lawyer. I'm a technologist, so I don't know if I can actually talk about fair use. In general, my understanding of it as a technologist and not, is that fair use is not a right. It's an affirmative defense against copyright violations. I think I should probably defer to Ian to continue.
That's exactly right. It's a defense. It's not a right. And it's a multi-part balancing test. So ultimately, unless you're prepared to go to trial and prove that you have a fair use right, in many instances there are issues at the margin. There certainly have been cases that stand for propositions, like the gentleman referred to, the Sony Betamax case, which held that time shifting was a fair use based on the facts of that case, which included the fact that there was no adverse impact on the market for genuine products. You change the facts slightly, you have time shifting that adversely impacts the market for genuine products, you may have a different case. And so a lot of these fair use decisions really have to be proven at trial, and that there's a certain amount of risk to that when you're talking about a defense rather than an absolute right.
Thanks very much. I think that's all the time we have. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight.
Different time, different place.
Now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Vanessa Richardson. I'm filling in for Alicia Woodgate, who could not be with us tonight. But I'm the 21st Century Speakers Series Chair of Inforum here at the Commonwealth Club, and I'm welcoming you to tonight's event, Digital Rights Management, the Battle Over Content.